appeared in the influenza statistics. There, deaths were not so few, and, more surprisingly, 40% of those who died were aged 20 to 35, a statistically extraordinary occurrence. In France, in late May, at one small station of 1,018 French Army recruits, 688 men were ill enough to be hospitalized, and 49 died. When 5% of an entire population, especially of healthy young adults, dies in a few weeks, that is frightening. By mid-June, Welch, Cole, Gorgas, and others were trying to gather as much information as possible about the progression of influenza in Europe. Cole could get nothing from official channels, but did learn enough from such people as Hans Zinser, a former and future Rockefeller investigator in the army in France, to become concerned. In July, Cole asked Richard Pierce, a scientist at the National Research Council who was coordinating war-related medical research, to make accurate information concerning the influenza prevailing in Europe a priority, adding, "I have inquired several times in Washington at the Surgeon General's office," referring to civilian Surgeon General Rupert Blue, head of the U.S. Public Health Service, not Gorgas. But no one seems to have any definite information in regard to the matter. A few days later, Cole showed more concern when he advised Pierce to put more resources into related research. In response, Pierce contacted several individual laboratory scientists, such as Paul Lewis in Philadelphia, as well as clinicians, pathologists, and epidemiologists, asking if they could begin new investigations. He would act as a clearinghouse for their findings. Between June 1st and August 1st, 200,825 British soldiers in France, out of 2 million, were hit hard enough that they could not report for duty even in the midst of desperate combat. Then, the disease was gone. On August 10th, the British command declared the epidemic over. In Britain itself, on August 20th, a medical journal stated that the influenza epidemic has completely disappeared. The weekly bulletin of the medical service of the American Expeditionary Force in France was less willing than the British to write off the influenza epidemic entirely. It did say in late July, "The epidemic is about at an end, and has been throughout of a benign type, though causing considerable non-effectiveness." But it went on to note, "Many cases have been mistaken for meningitis. Pneumonias have been more common sequelae in July than in April." In the United States, influenza had neither swept through the country as it had in Western Europe and parts of the Orient, nor had it completely died out. Individual members of the Army's Pneumonia Commission had dispersed to perform studies in several locations, and they still saw signs of it. At Fort Riley, which included Camp Funston, Captain Francis Blake was trying to culture bacteria from the throats of both normal and sick troops. It was desultory work, far less exciting than what he was accustomed to, and he hated Kansas. He complained to his wife, "No letter from my beloved for 2 days. No cool days, no cool nights, no drinks, no movies, no dances, no club, no pretty women, no shower bath, no poker, no people, no fun, no joy, no nothing save heat and blistering sun and scorching winds and sweat and dust and thirst and long and stifling nights and working all hours and lonesomeness and general hell." That's Fort Riley, Kansas. A few weeks later, he said it was so hot they kept their cultures of bacteria in an incubator so the heat wouldn't kill them. "Imagine going into an incubator to get cool," he wrote. He also wrote, "Have been busy on the ward all day. Some interesting cases, but most of it influenza at present." Influenza was about to become interesting. For the virus had not disappeared. It had only gone underground, like a forest fire left burning in the roots, swarming and mutating, adapting, honing itself, watching and waiting, waiting to burst into flame. Chapter 15. The 1918 influenza pandemic, like many other influenza pandemics, came in waves. The first spring wave killed few, but the second wave would be lethal. Three hypotheses can explain this phenomenon. One is that the mild and deadly diseases were caused by two widely different viruses. This is highly unlikely. Many victims of the first wave demonstrated significant resistance to the second wave, which provides strong evidence that the deadly virus was a variant of the mild one. The second possibility is that a mild virus caused the spring epidemic, and that in Europe it encountered a second influenza virus. The two viruses infected the same cells, reassorted their genes, and created a new and lethal virus. This could have occurred and might also explain the partial immunity some victims of the first wave acquired, but at least some scientific evidence directly contradicts this hypothesis, and most influenza experts today do not believe this happened. The third explanation involves the adaptation of the virus to man. In 1872, the French scientist C.J. Davin was examining a specimen of blood swarming with anthrax. To determine the lethal dose, he measured out various amounts of this blood and injected it into rabbits. He found it required 10 drops to kill a rabbit within 40 hours. He drew blood from this rabbit and infected a second rabbit, which also died. He repeated the process, infecting a third rabbit with blood from the second, and so on, passing the infection through 5 rabbits. Each time he determined the minimum amount of blood necessary to kill. He discovered that the bacteria increased in virulence each time, and after going through 5 rabbits, a lethal dose fell from 10 drops of blood to 1/100th of a drop. At the 15th passage, the lethal dose fell to 1/40,000th of a drop of blood. After 25 passages, the bacteria in the blood had become so virulent that less than 1/1,000,000th of a drop killed. This virulence disappeared when the culture was stored. It was also specific to a species. Rats and birds survived large doses of the same blood that killed rabbits in infinitesimal amounts. Davin's series of experiments marked the first demonstration of a phenomenon that became known as passage. This phenomenon reflects an organism's ability to adapt to its environment. When an organism of weak pathogenicity passes from living animal to living animal, it reproduces more proficiently, growing and spreading more efficiently. This often increases virulence. In other words, it becomes a better and more efficient killer. Changing the environment even in a test tube can have the same effect. As one investigator noted, a strain of bacteria he was working with turned deadly when the medium used to grow the organism changed from beef broth to veal broth. But the phenomenon is complex. The increase in killing efficiency does not continue indefinitely. If a pathogen kills too efficiently, it will run out of hosts and destroy itself. Eventually, its virulence stabilizes and even recedes. Especially when jumping species, it can become less dangerous instead of more dangerous. This happens with the Ebola virus, which does not normally infect humans. Initially, Ebola has extremely high mortality rates, but after it goes through several generations of human passages, it becomes far milder and not particularly threatening. So passage can also weaken a pathogen. When Pasteur was trying to weaken, or to use his word, attenuate the pathogen of swine erysipelas, he succeeded only by passing it through rabbits. As the bacteria adapted to rabbits, it lost some of its ability to grow in swine. He then inoculated pigs with the rabbit-bred bacteria, and their immune systems easily destroyed it. Since the antigens on the weak strain were the same as those on normal strains, the pigs' immune systems learned to recognize and destroy normal strains as well. They became immune to the disease. By 1894, veterinarians used Pasteur's vaccine to protect 100,000 pigs in France. In Hungary, over 1 million pigs were vaccinated. The influenza virus is no different in its behavior from any other pathogen, and it faces the same evolutionary pressures. When the 1918 virus jumped from animals to people and began to spread, it may have suffered a shock of its own as it adapted to a new species. Although it always retained hints of virulence, this shock may well have weakened it, making it relatively mild. Then, as it became better and better at infecting its new host, it turned lethal. McFarlane Burnett won his Nobel Prize for work on the immune system, but he spent the bulk of his career investigating influenza, including its epidemiological history. He noted an occasion when passage turned a harmless influenza virus into a lethal one. A ship carrying people sick with influenza visited an isolated settlement in East Greenland. 2 months after the ship's departure, a severe influenza epidemic erupted with a 10% mortality rate. 10% of those with the disease died. Burnett was reasonably certain that the epidemic was primarily virus influenza and concluded that the virus passed through several generations. He estimated 15 or 20 human passages in mild form before it adapted to the new population and became virulent and lethal. In his study of the 1918 pandemic, Burnett concluded that by late April 1918, the essential character of the new strain seems to have been established. He continued, "We must suppose that the ancestral virus responsible for the spring epidemics in the United States passaged and mutated." The process continued in France. Lethality lay within the genetic possibilities of this virus. This particular mutant swarm always had the potential to be more pestilential than other influenza viruses. Passage was sharpening its ferocity. As it smoldered in the roots, adapting itself, becoming increasingly efficient at reproducing itself in humans, Passage was forging a killing inferno. On June 30, 1918, the British freighter City of Exeter docked at Philadelphia after a brief hold at a maritime quarantine station. She was laced with deadly disease, but Rupert Blue, the civilian surgeon general and head of the U.S. Public Health Service, had issued no instructions to the maritime services to hold influenza-ridden ships. So she was released. Nonetheless, the condition of the crew was so frightening that the British consul had arranged in advance for the ship to be met at a wharf empty of anything except ambulances whose drivers wore surgical masks. Dozens of crew members in a desperate condition were taken immediately to Pennsylvania Hospital where, as a precaution against infectious disease, a ward was sealed off for them. Dr. Alfred Stengel, who had initially lost a competition for a prestigious professorship at the University of Pennsylvania to Simon Flexner, but who did get it when Flexner left, had gone on to become president of the American College of Physicians. An expert on infectious diseases, he personally oversaw the sailors' care. Despite Stengel's old rivalry with Flexner, he even called in Flexner's protege, Paul Lewis, for advice. Nonetheless, one after another, more crew members died. They seemed to die of pneumonia, but it was a pneumonia accompanied, according to a Penn medical student, by strange symptoms, including bleeding from the nose. A report noted the opinion was reached that they had influenza. In 1918, all infectious disease was frightening. Americans had already learned that Spanish influenza was serious enough that it had slowed the German offensive. Rumors now unsettled the city that these deaths, too, came from Spanish influenza. Those in control of the war's propaganda machine wanted nothing printed that could hurt morale. Two physicians stated flatly to newspapers that the men had not died of influenza. They were lying. The disease did not spread. The brief quarantine had held the ship long enough that the crew members were no longer contagious when the ship docked. This particular virulent virus, finding no fresh fuel, had burned itself out. The city had dodged a bullet. By now, the virus had undergone numerous passages through humans. Even while medical journals were commenting on the mild nature of the disease, all over the world hints of a malevolent outbreak were appearing. In London, the week of July 8th, 287 people died of influenzal pneumonia, and 126 died in Birmingham. A physician who performed several autopsies noted, "The lung lesions, complex or variable, struck one as being quite different in character to anything one had met with at all commonly in the thousands of autopsies one has performed during the last 20 years. It was not like the common bronchopneumonia of ordinary years." The U.S. Public Health Service's weekly Public Health Reports finally took notice, at last deeming the disease serious enough to warn the country's public health officials that an outbreak of epidemic influenza has been reported at Birmingham, England. The disease is stated to be spreading rapidly and to be present in other locations. And it warned of fatal cases. Earlier, some physicians had insisted that the disease was not influenza because it was too mild. Now others also began to doubt that this disease was influenza, but this time because it seemed too deadly. Lack of oxygen was sometimes so severe that victims were becoming cyanotic. Part or all of their bodies were turning blue, occasionally a very dark blue. On August 3rd, a U.S. Navy intelligence officer received a telegram that he quickly stamped secret and confidential. Noting that his source was reliable, he reported, "I am confidentially advised that the disease now epidemic throughout Switzerland is what is commonly known as the Black Plague, although it is designated as Spanish sickness and grip." Many histories of the pandemic portray the eruption of deadly disease, the hammer blow of the second wave, as sudden and simultaneous in widely separated parts of the world, and therefore deeply puzzling. In fact, the second wave developed gradually. When water comes to a boil in a pot, first an isolated bubble releases from the bottom and rises to the surface. Then another. Then two or three simultaneously. Then half a dozen. But unless the heat is turned down, soon enough all the water within the pot is in motion, the surface a roiling, violent chaos. In 1918, each initial burst of lethality, isolated though it may have seemed, was much like a first bubble rising to the surface in a pot coming to boil. The flame may have ignited in Haskell and set off the first burst. The outbreak that killed 5% of all French recruits at one small base was another. Louisville was still another, as were the deaths on the city of Exeter and the outbreak in Switzerland. All these were bursts of lethal disease, violent bubbles rising to the surface. Epidemiological studies written relatively soon after the pandemic recognized this. One noted that army cantonments in the United States saw a progressive increase in cases reported as influenza beginning with the week ending August 4th, 1918, and of the influenzal pneumonia cases beginning with the week ending August 18th. If this was really the beginning of the great epidemic wave, we should expect that if these series of data were plotted out on a logarithmic scale, the increase from week to week would plot out as a straight line following the usual logarithmic rise of an epidemic curve. This condition is substantially fulfilled with the curve of rise plotting out on logarithmic paper as a practically straight line. The report also found definite outbreaks of increasing severity occurring during the summer in both the United States and Europe, which indistinguishably blend with the great fall wave. In early August, the crew of a steamship proceeding from France to New York was hit so hard with influenza that all of the seamen were prostrate on it and it had to put into Halifax, according to an epidemiologist in Gorgas's office, where it remained until enough crew members were well enough to proceed to New York. On August 12th, the Norwegian freighter Bergensfjord arrived in Brooklyn after burying four men at sea, dead of influenza. It carried 200 people still sick with the disease. Ambulances transported many of them to a hospital. Royal Copeland, head of the New York City Health Department, and the Port Health Officer jointly stated there was not the slightest danger of an epidemic because the disease seldom attacks a well-nourished people. Even had he been right, a study by his own health department had just concluded that 20% of city schoolchildren were malnourished. He took no action whatsoever to prevent the spread of infection. A Navy bulletin warned of two steamships from Norway and one from Sweden arriving in New York City with influenza cases aboard on August 14th and 15th. On August 18th, New York papers described outbreaks on board the Rochambeau and New Amsterdam. Men from both ships had been taken to St. Vincent's Hospital. On August 20th, even Copeland conceded that influenza, though mild and, he claimed, certainly not in epidemic form, was present in the city. The lethal variant of the virus was finding its home in humans. Now, almost simultaneously, on three continents separated by thousands of miles of ocean, in Brest, in Freetown, Sierra Leone, and in Boston, the killing, rolling boil was about to begin. Nearly 40% of the 2 million American troops who arrived in France, 791,000 men, disembarked at Brest, a deep-water port capable of handling dozens of ships simultaneously. Troops from all over the world disembarked there. Brest had already seen a burst of influenza in the spring, as had many other cities, albeit, as in most of those other places, that influenza had been mild. The first outbreak with high mortality occurred in July in a replacement detachment of American troops from Camp Pike, Arkansas. They occupied an isolated camp and the outbreak initially seemed contained. It was not. By August 10th, the same day the British Army declared the influenza epidemic over, so many French sailors stationed at Brest were hospitalized with influenza and pneumonia that they overwhelmed the naval hospital there, forcing it to close. And the death rate among them began soaring. The August 19th New York Times took note of another outbreak. A considerable number of American Negroes, who have gone to France on horse transports, have contracted Spanish influenza on shore and died in French hospitals of pneumonia. Within another few weeks, all the area around Brest was in flames. American troops continued pouring into and then out of the city, mixing with French troops also training in the vicinity. When soldiers of both armies left the vicinity, they dispersed the virus en masse. Freetown, Sierra Leone, was a major coaling center on the West African coast, servicing ships traveling from Europe to South Africa and the Orient. On August 15th, the HMS Mantua arrived there with 200 crew suffering from influenza. Sweating black men loaded tons of coal into her, guided by several crew. When the laborers returned to their homes, they carried more than their wages. Soon influenza spread through the force of men who coaled the ships. And this influenza was not mild. On August 24th, two natives died of pneumonia while many others were still sick. On August 27th, the HMS Africa pulled into port. She too needed coal, but 500 of the 600 laborers of the Sierra Leone Coaling Company did not report to work that day. Her crew helped coal her, working side by side with African laborers. She carried a crew of 779. Within a few weeks, nearly 600 were sick, and 51 were dead. 7% of the entire crew died. The transport HMS Chepstow Castle, carrying troops from New Zealand to the front, coaled at Freetown on August 26th and 27th. Within 3 weeks, out of her 1,150 men, influenza struck down 900 of them. The death toll on her was 38. The Tahiti coaled at the same time. 68 men aboard her died before she reached England, the same day as the Chepstow Castle. After docking, crew of the two ships suffered 800 more cases and 115 more deaths. In Sierra Leone itself, officials soon after estimated that influenza killed 3% of the entire African population, nearly all of them dying within the next few weeks. More recent evidence suggests that the death toll was most likely considerably more than that, possibly double that figure, or higher. Across the Atlantic, at Commonwealth Pier in Boston, the Navy operated a receiving ship. The name was a misnomer. It was actually a barracks where as many as 7,000 sailors in transit ate and slept in what the Navy itself called grossly overcrowded quarters. On August 27th, two sailors reported to sickbay with influenza. On August 28th, 8 more sailors reported ill. On August 29th, 58 men were admitted. As in Brest and Freetown and aboard ship, men began to die. 50 of the men were quickly transferred to the Chelsea Naval Hospital, where Lieutenant Commander Milton Rosenau and his young assistant, Lieutenant John J. Keegan, worked. The sailors were in better than good hands. While Keegan would later become Dean of the University of Nebraska Medical School, Rosenau was one of the giants of the day. Strong, solid, and thick-necked, he looked as intimidating and determined as a wrestler staring down an opponent. Yet he was uniformly polite and supportive, and people enjoyed working under him. A prime mover in creating the U.S. Public Health Service Hygienic Laboratory, and later the president of the Society of American Bacteriologists, he was best known for his textbook, Preventive Medicine and Hygiene, which was referred to as the Bible for both Army and Navy medical officers. Only a few weeks earlier, he had met with Welch, Gorgas, and Vaughn to discuss how to prevent or contain any new epidemic. Rosenau and Flexner had had a running but friendly competition for years. In 1911, Rosenau had shown that Flexner had made an important mistake. 2 years later, Rosenau won the American Medicine Gold Medal in 1913 for proving that stableflies transmitted poliomyelitis. Flexner proved that finding to be in error in 1915. Yet each respected the other, and they got along well. Shortly before the war, with Harvard still underfunding medical research, Flexner wrote him, "I am astonished and pained to learn that you have so small a budget for your lab," and promptly arranged for a Rockefeller grant to him. Their cooperation was routine. For example, when Rosenau asked Flexner earlier in 1918, "Please send Chelsea Naval Hospital at once sufficient anti-meningitis serum for 4 patients." Rosenau and Keegan immediately isolated the sailors and did everything possible to contain the disease, working backward from each victim to trace and isolate people with whom the patients had had contact. But the disease was too explosive. They turned their attention to bacteriological analysis, seeking the pathogen so they could prepare a vaccine or serum. Their findings did not satisfy them, and within a few weeks they began using human volunteers from the Navy brig in the first experiments in the world to determine if a virus caused the disease. Long before that, any hopes of containing the disease had collapsed. On September 3rd, a civilian suffering from influenza was admitted to the Boston City Hospital. On September 4th, students at the Navy Radio School at Harvard, in Cambridge across the Charles River from Boston proper, fell ill. And then came Devon's. Chapter 16. Camp Devon's sat on 5,000 acres in rolling hills 35 miles northwest of Boston. It included fine farmland along the Nashua River, as well as what had been until recently heavily forested land cut down now to tree stumps. Like the other cantonments in the country, it was thrown together with amazing speed, at the rate of 10.4 buildings a day. In August 1917, it opened with 15,000 men, although the camp was incomplete. Its sewage was still being discharged directly into the Nashua River. Like most other camps, it had suffered from measles and pneumonia. The medical staff was first rate. An inspection of the Devon's hospital had given it an excellent review down to its kitchen, noting, "The mess officer is well informed and alert." In fact, the Devon's medical staff was so good that Frederick Russell was preparing to rely on it to launch several major new scientific investigations. One involved correlating the existence of streptococci in the mouths of healthy soldiers with streptococcal infections of the throat. Another sought an explanation for the far higher morbidity rates of pneumonia among blacks over whites. Still another involved measles. Late in the summer at Devon's, Major Andrew Sellar had passed infectious material from a recent measles case through a porcelain filter to isolate the virus, had inoculated 4 monkeys with it, and on August 29th began inoculating a series of human volunteers. The only problem at Devon's was that it was built to hold a maximum of 36,000 men. On September 6th, Devon's held just over 45,000 men. Still, the camp hospital could accommodate 1,200, and it was caring for only 84 patients. With enough medical personnel to run several simultaneous research efforts, with a highly competent clinical staff, with a virtually empty hospital, Devon's seemed ready for any emergency. It wasn't. A week before any reported illness in the harbor, Boston public health authorities worried a sudden and very significant increase reported the third week of August in the cases of pneumonia occurring in the Army cantonment at Camp Devon's in the district seems to justify a suspicion that an influenza epidemic may have started among the soldiers there. While the eruption at Devon's might still have come from the Navy Commonwealth Pier facility, it might also have developed independently. It might even have spread to Boston from Devon's. At any rate, on September 1st, 4 more soldiers at Devon's were diagnosed with pneumonia and admitted to the hospital. In the next 6 days, 22 more new cases of pneumonia were diagnosed. None of these, however, were considered to be influenza. On September 7th, a soldier from D Company, 42nd Infantry, was sent to the hospital. He ached to the extent that he screamed when he was touched, and he was delirious. He was diagnosed as having meningitis. The next day, a dozen more men from his company were hospitalized and suspected of having meningitis. It was a reasonable diagnosis. Symptoms did not resemble those of influenza, and a few months earlier, the camp had suffered a minor epidemic of meningitis, and the doctors, lacking any false pride, had even called Rosenau for help. He had come himself, along with 6 bacteriologists. They had worked nearly around the clock for 5 days, identifying and quarantining 179 carriers of the disease. Rosenau had left the camp impressed with Army medicine. Even though he and his staff had done much of the work, he had advised Navy superiors that the same effort would not have been possible in the Navy. Now, over the next few days, other organizations began reporting cases of influenza-like disease. The medical staff, good as it was, did not at first connect these various cases to each other or to the outbreak on Commonwealth Pier. They made no attempt to quarantine cases. In the first few days, no records of influenza cases were even kept because they were looked upon as being examples of the epidemic disease which attacked so many of the camps during the spring. In the overcrowded barracks and mess halls, the men mixed. A day went by. 2 days. Then, suddenly, noted an Army report, stated briefly, the influenza occurred as an explosion. It exploded indeed. In a single day, 1,543 Camp Devon's soldiers reported ill with influenza. On September 22nd, 19.6% of the entire camp was on sick report, and almost 75% of those on sick report had been hospitalized. By then, the pneumonias and the deaths had begun. On September 24th alone, 342 men were diagnosed with pneumonia. Devon's normally had 25 physicians. Now, as Army and civilian medical staff poured into the camp, more than 250 physicians were treating patients. The doctors, the nurses, the orderlies went to work at 5:30 a.m. and worked steadily until 9:30 p.m., slept, then went at it again. Yet on September 26th, the medical staff was so overwhelmed, with doctors and nurses not only ill but dying, they decided to admit no more patients to the hospital, no matter how ill. The Red Cross, itself by then overwhelmed by the spread of the disease to the civilian population, managed to find 12 more nurses to help and sent them. They were of little help. 8 of the 12 collapsed with influenza. 2 died. For this was no ordinary pneumonia. Dr. Roy Grist, one of the Army physicians at the hospital, wrote a colleague, "These men start with what appears to be an ordinary attack of la grippe or influenza, and when brought to the hospital, they very rapidly develop the most vicious type of pneumonia that has ever been seen. 2 hours after admission, they have the mahogany spots over the cheekbones, and a few hours later, you can begin to see the cyanosis extending from their ears and spreading all over the face, until it is hard to distinguish the colored men from the white." Blood carrying oxygen in arteries is bright red. Without oxygen in veins, it is blue. Cyanosis occurs when a victim turns blue because the lungs cannot transfer oxygen into the blood. In 1918, cyanosis was so extreme, turning some victims so dark, the entire body could take on color resembling that of the veins on one's wrists. It sparked rumors that the disease was not influenza at all, but the Black Death. Grist continued, "It is only a matter of a few hours then until death comes. It is horrible. One can stand it to see 1, 2, or 20 men die, but to see these poor devils dropping like flies. We have been averaging about 100 deaths per day. Pneumonia means in about all cases death. We have lost an outrageous number of nurses and doctors, and the little town of Ayer is a sight. It takes special trains to carry away the dead. For several days there were no coffins, and the bodies piled up something fierce. It beats any sight they ever had in France after a battle. An extra long barracks has been vacated for the use of the morgue, and it would make any man sit up and take notice to walk down the long lines of dead soldiers, all dressed and laid out in double rows. Goodbye, old pal. God be with you till we meet again." Welch, Cole, Victor Vaughn, and Frederick Russell, all of them colonels now, had just finished a tour of Southern Army bases. It was not their first such tour, and as before, knowing that an army barracks offered explosive tinder, they had been inspecting camps to find and correct any practice that might allow an epidemic to gain a foothold. They also spent much time discussing pneumonia. After leaving Camp Macon in Georgia, they had retired for a few days of relaxation to Asheville, North Carolina, the most fashionable summer retreat in the South. The Vanderbilts had built one of the most elaborate estates in the country there, and not many miles away, Welch's old colleague William Halstead had built a virtual castle in the mountains. Today, Halstead's home is a resort called the High Hamptons. At the Grove Park Inn, one of the most elegant settings in the city, they listened to a concert. Welch lit a cigar. A bellboy promptly told him smoking was not allowed. He and Cole withdrew to the veranda and began talking. Another bellboy asked them to please be quiet during the concert. Welch left in disgust. Meanwhile, Russell wrote Flexner, "We are all well. Welch, Vaughn, and Cole and I have had a very profitable trip and have begun to believe that immunity," in this he was referring to efforts to manipulate the immune system, "is the most important thing in pneumonia, as in other infectious diseases. It makes a good working hypothesis, and one we will try to follow up by working in the lab, wards, and in the field this fall and winter. Bonne chance." The group returned to Washington on a Sunday morning, relaxed and in good spirits. But their mood changed abruptly as they stepped off the train. An escort had been waiting for them, and his anxiety quickly communicated itself. He was taking them to the Surgeon General's office, immediately. Gorgas himself was in Europe. His deputy barely looked up as they opened the door. "You will proceed immediately to Devens. The Spanish influenza has struck that camp." They arrived at Devon's 8 hours later in a cold and drizzling rain. The entire camp was in chaos, the hospital itself a battlefield. The war had come home indeed. As they entered the hospital, they watched a continuous line of men filing in from the barracks, carrying their blankets or being themselves carried. Vaughn recorded this sight. Hundreds of young, stalwart men in the uniform of their country coming into the wards of the hospital in groups of 10 or more. They are placed on the cots until every bed is full, and yet others crowd in. The faces wear a bluish cast. A distressing cough brings up the blood-stained sputum. Care was almost non-existent. The base hospital, designed for 1,200, could accommodate at most, even with crowding beyond what is deemed permissible, according to Welch, 2,500. It now held in excess of 6,000. All beds had long since been filled. Every corridor, every spare room, every porch was filled, crammed with cots occupied by the sick and dying. There was nothing antiseptic about the site, and there were no nurses. When Welch arrived, 70 out of 200 nurses were already sick in bed themselves, with more falling ill each hour. Many of them would not recover. A stench filled the hospital as well. Bed linen and clothing were rank with urine and feces from men incapable of rising or cleaning themselves. Blood was everywhere, on linens, clothes, pouring out of some men's nostrils and even ears, while others coughed it up. Many of the soldiers, boys in their teens, men in their 20s, healthy, normally ruddy men, were turning blue. Their color would prove a deadly indicator. The sight chilled even Welch and his colleagues. It was more chilling still to see corpses littering the hallways surrounding the morgue. Vaughn reported, "In the morning, the dead bodies are stacked about the morgue like cordwood." As Cole recalled, they were placed on the floor without any order or system, and we had to step amongst them to get into the room where an autopsy was going on. In the autopsy room, they saw the most chilling sights yet. On the table lay the corpse of a young man, not much more than a boy. When he was moved in the slightest degree, fluid poured out of his nostrils. His chest was opened, his lungs removed, other organs examined carefully. It was immediately apparent this was no ordinary pneumonia. Several other autopsies yielded similar abnormalities. Cole, Vaughn, Russell, the other members of this scientific team were puzzled and felt an edge of fear. They turned to Welch. He had studied with the greatest investigators in the world as a young man. He had inspired a generation of brilliant scientists in America. He had visited and seen diseases in China, the Philippines, and Japan that were unknown in the United States. He had read scientific journals in many languages for years, heard back-channel gossip from all the leading laboratories in the world. Surely he would be able to tell them something, have some idea. He did not reassure. Cole stood beside him, thinking he had never seen Welch look nervous before or excited in quite this way. In fact, Cole was shaken. It was not surprising that the rest of us were disturbed, but it shocked me to find that the situation, momentarily at least, was too much for Dr. Welch. Then Welch said, "This must be some new kind of infection or plague." Welch walked out of the autopsy room and made 3 phone calls, to Boston, New York, and Washington. In Boston, he spoke to Bert Volbach, a Harvard professor and chief pathologist at the great Boston hospital, the Brigham, and asked him to perform autopsies. Perhaps there was a clue to this strange disease there. But Welch also knew that any treatment or prevention for this would have to come from the laboratory. From the Rockefeller Institute in New York, he summoned Oswald Avery. Avery had been refused a commission in the Rockefeller Army Unit because he was Canadian, but on August 1st he had become an American citizen. By coincidence, the same day Welch called him, Avery was promoted from private to captain. More importantly, he had already begun the investigations that would ultimately revolutionize the biological sciences. Influenza would confirm him in this work. Later that day, both Avery and Volbach arrived and immediately began their respective tasks. The third call Welch made was to Washington, to Charles Richard, the acting Army Surgeon General, while Gorgas was at the front. Welch gave a detailed description of the disease and his expectations of its course at Devens and elsewhere. For this was going to spread. He urged that immediate provision be made in every camp for the rapid expansion of hospital space. Richard responded instantly, sending orders to all medical personnel to isolate and quarantine all cases and segregate soldiers from civilians outside the camps. It is important that the influenza be kept out of the camps as far as practicable. Epidemics of the disease can often be prevented, but once established, they cannot well be stopped. But he also conceded the difficulty. There are few diseases as infectious as influenza. It is probable that patients become foci of infection before the active symptoms. No disease which the Army surgeon is likely to see in this war will tax more severely his judgment and initiative. He also warned both the Army Adjutant General and Chief of Staff, new men will almost surely contract the disease. In transferring men from Camp Devens, a virulent form of the disease will almost surely be conveyed to other stations. During the epidemic, new men should not be sent to Camp Devens, nor should men be sent away from that camp. The next day, with reports already of outbreaks in other camps, Richard tried to impress upon the Chief of Staff the lethality of the disease, relating what Welch had told him. The deaths at Camp Devens will probably exceed 500. The experience at Camp Devens may be fairly expected to occur at other large cantonments. With few exceptions, they are densely populated, a condition which tends to increase the chance for contact infection and the virulence and mortality of the disease. It may be expected to travel westward and involve successively military stations in its course. And he urged that the transfer of personnel from one camp to another be all but eliminated except for the most urgent military necessities. Gorgas had fought his own war to prevent epidemic disease from erupting in the camps. He had lost. On August 27th, the same day the first sailors at Commonwealth Pier fell ill, the steamer Harold Walker had departed Boston, bound for New Orleans. En route, 15 crew members had fallen ill. In New Orleans, the ship unloaded its cargo and put 3 crewmen ashore. The 3 men died. By then, the Harold Walker had proceeded to Mexico. On September 4th, physicians at the New Orleans Naval Hospital made the first diagnosis of influenza in any military personnel in the city. The sailor had arrived in New Orleans from the northeast. That same date, a second patient also reported ill with influenza. He was serving in New Orleans. 40 of the next 42 patients who entered the hospital had influenza or pneumonia. On September 7th, 300 sailors from Boston arrived at the Philadelphia Navy Yard. Many of them, mixing with hundreds of other sailors, were almost immediately transferred to the Navy base in Puget Sound. Others had already gone from Boston to north of Chicago to the Great Lakes Naval Training Station, the largest facility of its kind in the world. On September 8th, at the Newport Naval Base in Rhode Island, more than 100 sailors reported sick. The virus was reaching south along the coast, jumping inland to the Midwest, spanning the nation to the Pacific. Meanwhile, at the Chelsea Naval Hospital, Rosenau and his team of physicians were also overwhelmed, and well aware of the larger implications. Even before Avery arrived, he and Keegan had begun the first effort in the country, and possibly in the world, to create an immune serum that would work against this new mortal enemy. Simultaneously, Keegan sent off a description of the disease to the Journal of the American Medical Association, warning that it promises to spread rapidly across the entire country, attacking between 30 and 40% of the population and running an acute course. Keegan was incorrect only in that he limited his estimate to the entire country. He should have said the entire world. This influenza virus, this mutant swarm, this quasi-species had always held within itself the potential to kill, and it had killed. Now, all over the world, the virus had gone through roughly the same number of passages through humans. All over the world, the virus was adapting to humans, achieving maximum efficiency. And all over the world, the virus was turning lethal. Around the world from Boston, in Bombay, which like so many other cities had endured a mild epidemic in June, the lethal virus exploded almost simultaneously. There it quickly began killing at a rate more than double that of a serious epidemic of bubonic plague in 1900. As the virus moved, two parallel struggles emerged. One encompassed all of the nation. Within each city, within each factory, within each family, into each store, onto each farm, along the length of the track of the railroads, along the rivers and roads, deep into the bowels of mines and high along the ridges of the mountains, the virus would find its way. In the next weeks, the virus would test society as a whole and each element within it. Society would have to gather itself to meet this test or collapse. The other struggle lay within one tight community of scientists. They, men like Welch, Flexner, Cole, Avery, Lewis, Rosenau, had been drafted against their will into a race. They knew what was required. They knew the puzzle they needed to solve. They were not helpless. They had some tools with which to work. They knew the cost if they failed. But they had very little time indeed. Part 5. Explosion. Chapter 17. On September 7th, 300 sailors arrived from Boston at the Philadelphia Navy Yard. And what happened in Philadelphia from that point would prove too often to be a model for what would happen elsewhere. Philadelphia was already typical in its war experiences. Every city was being flooded by people, and in Philadelphia, shipbuilding alone had added tens of thousands of workers. In a few months, a great marsh had been transformed into the Hog Island Shipyard, the largest shipyard in the world, where 35,000 workers toiled among furnaces and steel and machinery. Nearby, the New York shipbuilding yard worked 11,500 men, and a dozen other shipyards each worked from 3,000 to 5,000 more. And the city was thick with other great industrial plants. Several munitions factories each employed several thousands at a single location. The J.G. Brill Company turned out a streetcar an hour and employed 4,000. Midvale Steel had 10,000 workers. Baldwin Locomotive, 20,000. Overcrowded before the war, with jobs sucking ever more workers into the city and the population swelling to 1.75 million, Philadelphia literally teemed with people. In 1918, a national publication for social workers judged living conditions in its slums, where most tenements still had outhouses servicing dozens of families, worse than on the Lower East Side of New York. Blacks endured even more squalid conditions, and Philadelphia had the largest African-American population of any northern city, including New York or Chicago. Housing was so scarce that Boy Scouts canvassed the area seeking rooms for newly arrived women with war jobs. Two, three, and four entire families would cram themselves into a single two- or three-room apartment, with children and teenagers sharing a bed. In rooming houses, laborers shared not just rooms but beds, often sleeping in shifts just as they worked in shifts. In those same tenements, the city's own health department had conceded that during the winter of 1917 to 18, the death rate has gone up owing to the high cost of living and scarcity of coal. The city offered the poor social services in the form of Philadelphia Hospital, known as Blockley, a poorhouse and an asylum. But it offered nothing else, not even an orphanage. The social elite and progressives ran whatever charitable activities that did exist. Even normal services such as schools were in short supply. Of the 20 largest cities in America, Philadelphia, the city of Benjamin Franklin, and the University of Pennsylvania spent less on education than all but one. In all of South Philadelphia, home to hundreds of thousands of Italians and Jews, there would be no high school until 1934. All this made Philadelphia fertile ground for epidemic disease. So did a city government incapable of responding to a crisis. Muckraker Lincoln Steffens called Philadelphia the worst governed city in America. He may well have been right. Even Tammany's use of power in New York was haphazard compared to that of the Philadelphia machine, which had returned to power in 1916 after a reformer's single term in office. Philadelphia's boss was Republican State Senator Edwin Vere. He had bested and mocked people who considered themselves his betters, people who despised him, people with such names as Wharton, Biddle, and Wanamaker. A short, thick-chested, and thick-bellied man, his nickname was the Little Fellow, Vere had his base in South Philadelphia. He had grown up there before the incursion of immigrants on a pig farm in a then-rural area called the Neck. He still lived there despite enormous wealth. The wealth came from politics. All city workers kicked back a portion of their salary to Vere's machine. To make sure none ever missed a payment, city workers received their salary not where they worked or in City Hall, a classic and magnificent Victorian building with curved shoulders and windows reminiscent of weeping willow trees, but across the street from City Hall in Republican Party headquarters. The mayor himself kicked back $1,000 from his pay. Vere was also the city's biggest contractor, and his biggest contract was for street cleaning, a contract he had held for almost 20 years. At a time when a family could live in comfort on $3,000 a year, in 1917 he had received over $5 million for the job. Not all of that money stayed in Vere's pockets, but even the part that left passed through them and paid a toll. Yet the streets were notoriously filthy, especially in South Philadelphia, where the need was greatest, where everything but raw sewage, and sometimes even that, ran through the gutters, and where the machine was strongest. Ironically, the very lack of city services strengthened the machine, since it provided what the city did not: food baskets to the poor, help with jobs and favors, and help with the police. The commissioner and many magistrates were in Vere's pocket. People paid for the favors with votes, which, like a medieval alchemist, he transmuted into money. The machine proved so lucrative that Edwin Vere and his brother William, a congressman, became philanthropists, giving so much to their church at Moyamensing Avenue and Morris Street that it was renamed the Abigail Vere Memorial Methodist Episcopal Church, after their mother. Not many churches are named after mere mortals, but this one was. Yet nothing about the machine was saintly. On primary election day in 1917, several Vere workers blackjacked two leaders of an opposing faction, then beat to death a policeman who intervened. The incident outraged the city. Vere's chief lieutenant in 1918 was Mayor Thomas B. Smith. In his one term in office, he would be indicted, although acquitted, on three entirely unrelated charges, including conspiracy to murder that policeman. That same election, however, gave Vere absolute control over both the select and common councils, the city's legislature, and broad influence in the state legislature. Director of the Philadelphia Department of Public Health and Charities was Dr. Wilmer Crewson, a political appointee who served at the mayor's pleasure and whose term automatically expired with the mayor's. Crewson, a decent man whose son would become a surgeon at the Mayo Clinic, was as good an appointment as the machine made. But he lacked background in, commitment to, or understanding of public health issues. and he was by nature someone who thought most problems disappeared on their own. He was not someone to rush into a thing. He certainly would exert no pressure whatsoever on the machine to advance the public health. Although a gynecologist, he refused even to help the military in its massive national campaign against prostitution. Even New Orleans had succumbed to pressure to close Storyville, where prostitution was legal, but no pressure could make Philadelphia, where prostitution remained illegal, in any way hinder its flesh industry. So, according to a military report, the Navy actually took control of police affairs outside its installations. The city government was choking on corruption, with lines of authority split among Vare, precinct captains turned entrepreneurs, and the mayor. It did not wish to act, nor could it if it chose to. 4 days after the arrival of the sailors from Boston at the Navy Yard, 19 sailors reported ill with symptoms of influenza. Lieutenant Commander R.W. Plummer, a physician and chief health officer for the Philadelphia Naval District, was well aware of the epidemic's rage on Commonwealth Pier and at Devon's, and its spread to the civilian population in Massachusetts. Determined to contain the outbreak, he ordered the immediate quarantine of the men's barracks and the meticulous disinfecting of everything the men had touched. In fact, the virus had already escaped, and not only into the city. One day earlier, 334 sailors had left Philadelphia for Puget Sound. Many would arrive there desperately ill. Plummer also immediately called in Paul.